Let me get this straight.
Experimental days of broadcasting as such are over.
Thursday, January 17th, CITR celebrates art's birthday with another 24 hours of radio art.
To confuse.
The Art of Sounds. Thursday, January 17th, midnight to midnight. 24 hours of radio art. Happy birthday, Art. From CITR 101.9, Vancouver. For CITR.ca.
Well, of course, that's the sound you don't hear very often. But it is the real thing.
You must keep reminding yourself. It's just a
sound collage.
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 Only a madman could understand it all.
I can understand that.
All right. Enough of this happy birthday stuff. Enough of these songs and games. Enough of this fun. Because Oscar the Grouch is here to tell you what a really good birthday party is like. I'm here to tell you about what it's like to be at a Grouch's birthday party. And I'm not going to wish you a happy birthday either. So just be quiet and listen.
Hour 14 into 24 hours of radio art. And yeah, getting a little grouchy. I've been here since midnight, but... Thank you very much, Allison Benjamin, for the last hour of classic sound collage and audio art in celebration of Art's birthday here on CITR 101.9 FM. We will now pass you over to the next hour, the two-year anniversary of the Ink Studs radio show. Your host is Robin McConnell. Take it away, Robin.
Thank you.
Wait. Mason. But of course, it's not for everybody.
He's screaming the truth.
I won't
believe
America's killing its youth. Hello.
Check. Test, check.
CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Inkstud Show, the radio show where we talk about comics, and that's my own little 5 minutes of art noise. Before I got into comics, I was actually a DJ. Well, no, I got into comics as a teenager, and then, you know, meet girls and yada yada. I DJed for a number of years and used to actually do a lot of noise, experimental stuff, so art noise is...
Going back to mama.
You know what, Don? I don't like that mic.
Okay, let's try a different one.
There we go. So
check. There we go.
Oh, that's much better. You sound beautiful, Don. So, CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Inkstud, so we're sure we talk about comics. Now, my plan was, I had this genius plan to have all these guys on air.
Round table.
A round table discussion, and I've got one of them. But luckily...
So it's like a triangle table.
Yeah, it's... So our guest today, Jeet here, who has been a guest of the Inkstuds a couple of times now, came on to talk about Crazy Cat.
And then, we did a show about Walton Skizik where I was on with Chris Ware.
Exactly, which was a fantastic show. I had a great time for that one, and I think you enjoyed it too, didn't you?
Yeah, no, it was great. Yeah, of course. So, Dan Nadell and Tom Spurgeon aren't available?
Not answering their phones.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Some people don't have voicemail, apparently.
Well, Tom did, but Dan didn't.
Yeah.
So, in case you guys happen to be listening, 822-2487, 604-822-2487. And actually, if anyone wants to call in and comment on what we're discussing, you can too as well. Basically, what we're going to do today is we've been doing the show for over 2 years. I really like the strong part of the show. Like, it started out, and there were some painful parts at the beginning that I don't think anyone needs to listen to ever again.
No.
Poor Seth got stuck being my first interview ever. And,
could have been worse.
Not for him.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So we've been doing the show for a while now, and today being, if you don't know, and I'm sure a lot of people don't know, is a lot of radio stations do something celebrating the birthday of art, quote unquote, and I forget what the original root or the meaning, the birthday of art. If the music director was here somewhere, I'd get him to come on and say exactly why we call January 17th art's birthday. Art not being Art Spiegelman, but art, the art itself.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So today what I want to do is have all these interesting guests come on. Mm-hmm. And Don and I, you haven't met Don before, Jeet, but I'm joined by Don.
No, King. I haven't.
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
And we came up with a list of questions for a discussion. So we're still going to do the discussion, but it's going to be the three of us. But that's okay.
Oh, that's fine. Yeah. Is it? Do you guys have a computer so you could email Dan or Tom?
I will be doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. We're on it.
Yeah. So I'm going to let Don start out with, because he's done this masterful list of questions.
Yeah, I have. Well, it's not really questions. I actually have been going through, just so I don't sound like I'm name-dropping the entire hour, I actually went through a lot of old notebooks and art books and comic-related stuff and just pulled different quotes from different people about what is comic art, like conflicting views, who is it, or should it be aimed at, what does it do, influences and things, just sort of a general bunch of stuff that can relate to comics in general. And I don't know, I was just going to throw out the first thing is what is comic, say, as what are comics as an art? Are they big A art? Are they illustrations? Are they, what basically defines art or defines comics as comics as opposed to different types of art, you know?
Well, I think that, like, that question depends on whether you believe that there's comics have an essence, if there's an essentialist view of comics, which is that they are one thing and not another, or there's another way of looking at comics, which is to say that they're hybrid, that they're a mixture of things. Mm-hmm. And I really don't like any sort of essentialist view of comics, because I think the inherent nature of the medium is that it always is mixed. And so Art Spiegelman, talking about art, said, you know, comics are a bastard form of mixing commerce and fine art, right?
Mm-hmm.
The earliest, almost all cartoonists do it for a living.
Yes.
Or if not now, at least for most of...
They try to.
And so it's not... And comics, certainly, like the original newspaper comics and later comic books, appeared as a commercial medium. In that sense, they're inherently hybrid, that you have people creating works of art, but they're doing it in a commercial way, as with movies. So there's an inherent tension there. And there's also an inherently hybrid, because they mix, comics do, words and pictures, which, if you have a purist view of art, is questionable. I mean, there are people who write books and try to write pure prose, and there are people who try to make pure paintings.
Mm-hmm.
But comics can't have that sort of purity. And so I think in terms of what comics are, I think we have to say that comics are a mutt. They're like, mm-hmm. you know, Little Orphan Annie's dog, Sandy.
Yeah.
They're a mixed breed.
Yeah.
And having said that, like in terms of like where comics stand in the spectrum of art, I think it depends on the cartoonist as well. There's mm-hmm. certain cartoonists that are very close to being fine artists. Like, I think someone like Gary Panter,
mm-hmm.
Almost any page he does could hang on a museum wall very easily.
Yeah, that's funny.
But there are other cartoonists who are equally good, but who are very much working at the, how should I say it, the sort of print end of things.
Yes,
their comics are really designed to be on the printed page. I think maybe Ernie Bushmiller is perhaps the purest example of this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think people would necessarily fetishize a Bushmiller original, or if they would, it's only after they've seen Nancy in the comics page or in book form. That there's a sense in which Nancy has to be in sort of in printed form
first. In that context, yeah.
In that context. And then later on, you might appreciate it as fine art. So that's the sort of spectrum, from Bushmiller to Gary Panter.
Yeah, that's true. It's funny because when you mentioned Gary Panter, he did remind me of, there's a great quote I found by Dave McKeon, who I kind of look at him that way too. He's like somebody mm-hmm. that he's a fine artist that makes comics, you know, and that comes across. But he said his definition of comics was as broad as he could make it, because he figured that it could encompass so many different things. He didn't want to limit himself to what it could possibly do. And I was also going to mention when you were talking about like the part of commerce involved and making a living, basically. I found this
You know what? I'm going to bring someone on air.
Okay.
Have a caller.
Oh, okay. Just one second.
Okay. Who we got with us?
Hi, it's Dan.
There we go.
Yay!
Sorry to cut you off, Don.
I'll
just introduce our other guest. We got Jeet here, who is a talented scholar in the world of comics, especially classical comics. And Dan Nadel, who is the publisher of Picturebox Books as well. You can catch him online at comicsmag.blogspot.com. Being one of the few comics related blogs that don't make me angry, or that doesn't make me angry.
And we should also say that Dan is the editor of a really great book called Art Out of Time,
which
collects great forgotten cartoonists.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is an awesome book. If that's we sell that at the store I work at. Those fly off the shelf. They're just
cool.
Everybody loves it. You just kind of came in. We were just talking about sort of the differences between. Like, what is comic art, and is there a difference between the commercial aspect to it and like a fine art look at it? Do you have any sort of opinions on is there a difference between, like I found this great quote. I'm pulling quotes out from different people. And there's a great quote from Andrew Loomis, who said he was an illustrator. And he said that there's no such thing as commercial art. There's just art. And art itself doesn't change. And what one learns to do is to apply the principles on the behalf of industry. And I kind of took that, applied that to comics, where I kind of see comics a little bit like that, where it's art, and it's just you apply the different principles of comics to your artwork, or vice versa. But I was wondering if anybody else felt that, or if that's just me yakking. Well, it got quiet.
Well, actually, I mean, one way of dealing with that issue, and maybe this could bring Dan in as well, mm-hmm. is I know Dan has very strong feelings about the Masters of American comic show. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think that one of the issues that show raised is to what degree can comics be integrated into museums? Because there were some artists that worked very well on the museum wall. I mentioned Gary Panter. Mm-hmm. But there's others who are like equally great cartoonists who didn't. And I think E.C. Segar is one of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. I love Segar to pieces, but in some ways, you have to read his comics like in book form or yeah. in the original form. Mm-hmm. There's nothing you really gain from it being on the museum wall. I don't know. Dan, do you want to jump in here?
Well, I guess I feel like it's like two different subjects almost. One mm-hmm. is the idea of comics and how it relates to fine art, and then the other one is how comics live in museums. And
mm-hmm. Yeah, that's.
I think
yeah.
that comics in museums, it's a strange thing because unlike, and I guess I've written about this a little bit, is unlike a painting or sculpture or any number of things that are actually created to be seen in a sort of white cube environment, comics aren't. Comics, the original art is sort of an artifact that's not actually the final product. You know, it's an ink drawing on its way to being
reproduced,
a complete piece of art. So showing them on the museum walls is never really going to be satisfying because you're never actually seeing the whole thing. I've always thought it would be more interesting for somebody to come up with a way to show it as, rather than showing them sort of essentially as drawings, to show them as comics. And I don't have any major bright ideas about that, but I'm sure there's a way. And I thought the Masters show really kind of made a really great argument as to why
it doesn't work.
Why it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And also why applying the kind of thinking that went into curating that show to anything isn't really good, but in particular to comics, because it's so retrograde.
Yeah, I do get the impression that it does, when they try to force comics onto a gallery wall, sometimes it's like a fish out of water, you know, it's almost just, I like it when people make an effort to have something in a gallery that has to be in the gallery because then it serves a purpose, but most comics aren't made for that. You
know? I just got to say something real quick. Sorry.
Uh-huh.
Tom's online with us too. Tom Spurgeon.
Awesome.
From the Comics Reporter, who is another comics blog that doesn't make me angry.
Yes.
That I read. So say hi, Tom.
I wish I could say the same.
Yeah.
You know, I think the reason I'm late, I got into a fog. I was coding one of Bart Beattie's massive articles where he name drops like 3,500 European artists. And I temporarily blacked out, and so therefore I'm late. Hey, what are we talking about?
Yeah.
And I should mention the other person that's joining me in the studio is Don King,
yes.
Who is an occasional Inkstuds contributor. And,
hey.
You know. All-around swell guy who
yeah.
is way more prepared than I am on most points.
we're just talking about like the sort of the weird balance between comics, like comics as an art, as opposed to comics as art that goes on a gallery wall, where sometimes it's not. It's like a fish out of water or something.
Now that I've got all three of you on, I'm going to start out with a question that I actually originally want to start out with. Because all three of you are very involved in the comics community, different aspects. What I'm curious is, why comics? Why is it something that's important to each of you as kind of vocation, interest? Because and all of you are very like involved in critical ways of comics, too. Like, I mean, critical in the looking at comics in different aspects.
Hmm.
So, Dan, I'll start with you.
Okay, I'm up first. Why comics? Let's see.
What is it about the comics medium that grabs you more than, you know?
It's probably what grabs a lot of people. It's like this amazing form that, you know, as somebody that is in love with images and art in general and looking at things and also someone who loves to read, it's a perfect combination. And, I mean, there's this sort of formal aspect like that I love the actual experience of it, of reading and looking at the same time. And then there's all the sort of other stuff. I love the history. It's a totally oddball history where there's still a huge amount to be discovered and learned and uncovered. You know, it's a history that feels like it's only getting deeper the more people are involved in discussing it. And I like the kind of genres that it allows. I like that you can pretty much do anything in it equally well, which is true of literature and a film. But in comics, there's something that allows an almost more idiosyncratic take on all these different genres because it's just sort of one person or a couple of people producing these things. So that's a short version, I guess.
Who's next?
Tom?
I'll go. You know, I'm in comics by accident. It seemed like a better job than the job I had at the time. So, which I was working for one of the home shopping networks doing horrible, horrible things to people. So that anything in comics sounded much better than that. It's not even my favorite art form, I think. If I had to choose one to look at and do for the rest of my life, it might not make the cut. But, you know, I think what's tremendously exciting about it as a critic is kind of some of what Dan hinted at, which is it has the oddest history of any kind of industry art form out there. And this is a very exciting time to be a part of that history and to be commenting on that thing and being able to drive people to, you know, interesting work and great work. And certainly, you know, maybe if I'd been around in the early 70s, I'd have been writing about film, you know, or if it'd been in the 40s and 30s and 40s, I'd been writing about the stage or whatever with that same kind of excitement. But since, you know, comics is kind of emerging and kind of emerging from this really wacky history and kind of a not very commented upon one, it's really exciting to be able to talk about comics.
And that leaves you, Gene.
Yeah, I just, well, I mean, I think Dan and Tom have hit on most of the main key points, but I think just to reinforce them a little bit, what's exciting is that it's sort of virgin territory. Like, if you're going into literature, if you want, you know, there have been literally thousands of books written about Shakespeare and Dickens. They're books been written about comics, but a lot of them aren't that good. And there's a lot of major cartoonists that haven't had their biography or their lives done yet. Even someone like Harriman, I mean, there's a sort of good book on Harriman, but there's a lot to still say about Harriman, and he's the greatest, you know, cartoonist of the last century. So in some ways, what Tom said about the timing is also really important. If I were, like, I think the best time to be a literary critic in the recent past would have been in the 1930s, if you were Edmund Wilson, and T.S. Eliot had just come out with The Wasteland, and Joyce just wrote Ulysses, and Wilson was one of the first to write about those, and he could really explain these, you know, difficult, interesting works to a large audience. The best time to have been a film critic would have been in the 70s, when The Godfather and the early Martin Scorsese movies were coming out, and you could be Pauline Kael and trying to explain these very exciting movies to the public. So as a critic, I feel like I'm really working in the wake of, you know, Mouse coming out, the Hernandez brothers, and Jimmy Corrigan. And these are, you know, like really major works, and I can be among the first to write about them in an intelligent and interesting way. So I mean, that's really exciting.
How important is criticism to kind of furthering comics as looking beyond just the biff bam pow?
As an art form, yeah. Like, because I just found a quote from was it Ben Sean, I think, that said, read everything you can find about art except the reviews. And he said to read the Bible, read Hume, and read Pogo. Those are his suggestions, you know.
Well, I mean, in the history of comics, I can certainly point to where critics have an important, and one is Gary Groff in the Comics Journal.
Yeah.
And it's sort of interesting because, you know, when Gary was working in the late 70s and early 80s, comics were sort of dying, and you had Marvel and DC, but the undergrounds were sort of dead, and what Marvel and DC weren't doing were very interesting. And Gary came up with a sort of aesthetic agenda even before he had comics to back him up. Like, he thought that comics should be an art. And then, fortunately, the Hernandez brothers came along, and Raw Magazine came along, so Gary has something to comment on. But he's very much a part of what was happening in the 80s in the terms of saying that comics had to have a higher agenda, a higher aspirations, and really pushing good comics. And I think that had a tremendous impact, which I think Tom will be dealing with in his, I hope, soon-to-be-released book.
I'm looking forward to that, actually. I really am.
That's a big... That's, you know, I think that you're right about Gary's influence and the influence of those writers at that specific point of time. You know, another way that you can mark the importance of a critical dialogue about comics is by pointing out the fact that Gary and writers like, you know, Carter Scholes and Bob Fiore kind of had to invent the idea of art comics for themselves all over again. And if there were a sustained critical dialogue in the decades before that, there wouldn't be, you know, all of this rediscovery that we have to do of comics that are art, the comics, you know, that function as art comics do now. They seem really obvious when we go back to them, but because there was nobody talking about them, you almost didn't, and because they're, you know, such a rare thing and hard to find, you can't, you know, there's no way to make those connections. So they kind of had to come up with definitions and standards all over again, and kind of now have to go back, kind of scanning through history, kind of, you know, something that Dan's done, and then kind of pull things in that might not have been considered that way. And if there were a critical dialogue, I think we'd have been much further along, and then things would have been much different in terms of those ideas.
Yeah, I also found that the history of comics is such a strange one too, as opposed to like a lot of other art forms, that it's almost like I work in a store, and it's hard to recommend for people comics that they'd be interested in if they don't have a background in comics. And I think a lot of that is kind of being re-looked at too, like where if you ask somebody what a great comic was 20 years ago, everybody would say Jack Kirby, but good luck explaining to somebody off the street why that's a good comic book. And I think we've had to kind of go back and start like looking at like almost like categorizing certain things and trying to look back on things and put them in a great historical perspective, you know?
Sure. I mean, there's some things that weren't even in the dialogue. You know, you didn't talk about, you know, Peanuts was seen as a very different thing than what the Hernandez brothers did. So different, like you couldn't even have them in the same magazine or the same conversation as far as, you know, greatness goes or as far as their quality goes. So, yeah, I think those things, those you know, just having, getting used to talking about them, I think that has had a great effect on how we look at a lot of the books.
And if I just can add something to this, I think the most interesting cartoonist that are currently working are the ones who are the most interested in criticism or the most theoretically sophisticated. Like, I think Chris Ware is a sort of the obvious example of this, but certainly if you look at the Comics blog that Dan does, you know, Frank is like a great cartoonist and also very sophisticated as a critic of comics. And Art Spiegelman, I mean, in some ways, the idea that, you know, art doesn't need criticism just doesn't ring very true to me. And a lot of this rediscovery of the past is coming from cartoonists themselves. It's sort of Chris Ware that pushed for the rediscovery of Frank King. It's Seth that's pushing for the rediscovery of Doug Wright. Mm-hmm. So, it's a very exciting thing, and it's a process whereby criticism and art are working hand in hand. And there's also a lot of work still to be done. As you know, I mean, I think I mentioned Dan's book earlier. Like, I think what's exciting about that book is it showed that there's, you know, whole cartoonists that most of us have never heard of who did like an exciting body of work.
Dan.
Yeah. And I think also what's interesting about the sort of dialogue between criticism and artists is just that, you know, if you look at, for example, like the artists in Raw, so many of them were basing their work off of, you know, Kirby or Gould and or Bushmiller. And I think that increasingly, as people write about different kinds of cartoonists, it's just going to, in much the same way, kind of change the focus of what artists are drawing. Mm-hmm. And I think that can be really interesting. I think often, because comics is so marginal, people kind of want to downplay the idea of criticism and things like that, which is a real mistake because it can only add to it. It's not a, you know, it doesn't detract. And I think it can really unearth things and also just unearth new ideas because overall comics is a fairly homogenous place. So, and any kind of difference of ideas is always good.
It's always welcome. Yeah, actually, one thing that did remind me of is I just read a thing by Stuart Davis where he was talking about how he made a painting based on like a Champion spark plug matchbook or something like that. And he would, I can't remember, like I don't have the exact quote, but it was the idea behind it too was that he said it's not what you use as your influence or your inspiration, it's what you do with it. And I think that's comics is one place where you really see that. You can take somebody that grew up reading, you know, like a lot of stuff made for 5-year-olds from 1956, and they can put that into their work and show people an aspect of that they never might have noticed before. You know, I really enjoy that, like the history that comes out, you know, more and more.
Looking at at comics as a history, do any of you feel like there's an aspect where, you know, things have changed because kind of more for the more mature level, like what point do you see there's a change or has there been a change? Is it something that was pulled under? Because looking at like your book, Dan, you know, there's this whole milieu, I guess, of really smart stuff throughout time. But, you know, the average look at comics, people think, you know, of the 50s and 60s. Well, not the 50s because we had the EC stuff, but, mm-hmm. you know, the 60s were a glut of superhero fandom. Yeah. So is there a time like, because you look at the early strips, which are very mature, very introspective, some of them. Is there a point where, you know, a shift in looking at it?
I think that, I think it's kind of interesting. It definitely, things kind of peaked in the teens, 20s, and 30s in terms of sophistication mm-hmm. and maturity of the strips, and the comic books come in, and things kind of bottom out a little bit in a funny way. But and then in the 50s, things kind of, they're great horror comics and great crime comics and great comic strips like Peanuts and you know, Virgil Parch and Steinberg and Steig. And I mean, there's great stuff all the way through. I think it just depends on what you're looking for. I definitely think that after the heyday of the comic strips, after World War II, the idea, the sort of comics emulating literary forms, like with Gasoline Alley or the Bungo Family and things like that, those kind of realist, like American dramas, faded more or less. You still have Gasoline Alley, and I guess for better or for worse, and things like that later. But the kind of the burst of it, the dies, and it goes into other things. And certainly, you know, I'm not going to make an argument for, you know, a Howard Nostrand mm-hmm. horror comic from the 50s being as sophisticated as Gasoline Alley. It's a different kind of pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really depends on what you're looking for. I think somebody like Booty Rogers is actually pretty sophisticated and pretty wonderful as an artist. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It kind of waxes and wanes. But I Jeet could probably speak better to the idea of what sort of happened to the strips.
Yeah, I'm going to interject for just a second. It reminded me of like the way that strips became, you know, they went into comic books, and then it almost like they took everything that they learned in comic strips and threw it in the garbage and kind of started.
Yeah.
New. It's totally like, it reminds me of, it's sort of analogous with like a silent film, where like silent films, like they hit their peak, and then when they started sound films, they basically threw everything that they knew and threw it in the garbage and started with something else, you know?
Yeah, well, I think that's very often the case in sort of commercial art, that the shelf life is very short. You have you know, even things like ragtime or in popular music, you have like a new form that develops and people develop mastery over 5 or 10 years, and then the next fad comes along and there's a rediscovery. So comics in a lot of ways seem to me like a sort of phoenix art form. They're constantly dying and they're constantly being reborn. And so you can sort of point to peak moments, but they don't like accumulate anything. So Winsor McCay did all these amazing things and he had a few imitators, but by 1914, nobody was really doing Winsor McCay. And then you had the great realist strips of the 20s and 30s who had their peak. But once comic books came along, then you had superheroes and EC. And so there's no real sense of continuity or accumulation. You just have like these, you know, great flashes, usually for about 5 or 10 years, and then a sort of fade out. I think that might actually change now. Like, I think now with the sort of graphic novels and now with all these sort of reprints, we're getting a much greater sense of the sort of the range of comics history. And there's a way in which, like, sort of contemporary artists have a sense of history and are looking to the past. So they're sort of filling in the gaps, or they're sort of creating a tradition where one didn't exist before.
Yeah, I think that's true, but I also think that while there's not a lot of continuity in content in comics, one of the really interesting things to look at is a continuity of style, where, and I think you're right, that certainly guys like McKay, sort of those guys up until the teens, definitely kind of dropped off. But then something starts to happen where you have somebody like Roy Crane, And then Sickles and Kniff, and moving into the superhero comics, and then Kirby, and interesting little stylistic strands start to develop that you see that run all the way through and in each genre. And I think that's probably because it's genre work that.
And you see that actually in humor as well, with Milt Gross, leading to Kurtzman, leading to Spiegelman and Crumb. So there's that actually sort of contradicts what I just said there.
No, but what you did say, I think the content, I think you're kind of right about. I think that, that certainly, if there was a sense of continuity in comics, if it was a kind of more linear art form, guys like Fletcher Hanks wouldn't exist.
Yeah.
It wouldn't necessarily allow for the oddballs to even be published.
Yeah.
So
it's the glory of comics.
The choppiness of it.
Fletcher Hanks, that's something that kind of is an interest as far as like re-examining comics or looking at what people are doing with it. Like, what... Some people think of him as like, I don't really like this phrase, but the Ed Wood of comics. Like, why is someone like him important to be published right now for us to look back at that?
You know, I think it's the opposite. It being the opposite that he's the opposite of Ed Wood in comics. I mean, I thought those comics were really beautiful and kind of lovely to look at and really compelling on every level that Ed Wood's aren't. I couldn't really understand, you know, I guess the only reason you would laugh at him is because those comics are so weird. But, I mean, I find them really affecting art, and they kind of need to be published on that basis. And, I'm kind of uncomfortable with the way that a lot of those comics have been presented to a certain extent. It kind of lessened my enjoyment that it kind of trotted out like a circus freak.
Yeah, like look at all the goofy crap that you missed or something. Sideshow.
Or the way it was kind of presented, like, you know, he had to be presented. Like there was some kind of show aspect to it. I was kind of uncomfortable with that, and I'm actually writing about that right now a little bit. I just think that those were really good, compelling, you know, imaginative, beautiful comics.
I think sometimes we lose that. What I found so strange about the reaction to it, I mean, I'm thrilled that the book did so well, but I think it's so funny. Only in comics would people be like, whoa, like, that stuff's crazy.
Yeah.
You know, because it's actually not. It's just really well-crafted graphic art by a pretty idiosyncratic creator. I mean, the actual way he's drawing and the compositions, it's not that far out. It just happens to be a little bit far out for comics. And that people think that's weird, but that, I don't know, Mary Worth is normal.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually kind of the flip side of the rest of the kind of visual arts world, which is, you know, Yeah, it's just funny to me.
Yeah.
I mean, if Fletcher Hanks to me is like, oh, that's good superhero comics. End of story.
Is that something that holds comics back as an industry, is the kind of narrow-minded fanboyism of things?
Like, if it doesn't have a superhero in it, it's not worth reading. Is that still prevalent, do you think? Because I noticed that there's even, like, all the mainstream guys now, most of them came out of doing alternative or independent comics, and now they're doing, you know, Batman. And you know,
don't cry, Don.
Oh, no. Well, whatever, you know. I don't know. It just seems kind of disappointing to me that people would come from, like, an area where they can do anything, and they were doing different things, and then now, to make a buck, they all do Batman. I don't know. I just find it kind of discouraging sometimes.
Anyone? No one?
There wasn't a question.
Just talking to myself.
There wasn't.
No, I mean, it's obviously. I mean, it's really weird when you think about it that a genre that's created in the late 1930s still dominates so much. I mean, it's not like in radio is still dominated by.
Drama.
I don't know, Amos and Andy.
Yeah.
Right.
If you turn on the radio and you just had Amos and Andy and Jack Benny being played now, people would think that's odd. Mm-hmm. And so on that level, it's discouraging. But I mean, the thing is, that's only like such a small part of comics. If you take a sort of global perspective, or you know, I mean, there's a lot of people that are doing a lot of exciting work, I mean, it's only like a sort of trap if you let it be a trap.
I guess.
I always thought the closest comparison was to superheroes are to comics, to American comics, what musical theater is to theater in general, and that it's very. At least in the way that people consume it, and that it has very unique and idiosyncratic ways of telling stories that, for some people, this works far beyond what other, or, you know, so far beyond what other comics works, or other kind of form, that form work, that it becomes, like, the dominant vision of it in their eye. And also, you know, there's a publicity thing, kind of generalist view that, you know, comics equals superheroes, you know, theater equals, you know, a guy singing about his feelings at you. And so, you know, I don't think it's, I think if you look at it that way, it doesn't need to be crippling or anything, but it kind of needs to be considered in the kind of, I think it's kind of an odd thing and kind of a curious thing rather than a crippling or a harmful thing.
Did it sound like you, Dan, did you have something to chirp in there? Or?
Do I?
I thought that was you going.
No, I think those guys pretty much summed it up. Okay. I think that sometimes the reverse happens, and I found that, I think Thomas found this too and talks about it on his blog, that because this sort of idea, like, we've come so far, let's not go back, that there's sometimes an allergy to science fiction or superheroes or you know, mystery or suspense stuff.
Yeah,
the kind of you know, whatever you want to call it, sophisticates of comics, and I think that sometimes is a problem, because after all, you know, literary fiction is as much a genre as science fiction, and so I sometimes think it works in reverse, which is which is problematic unto itself, but not. You know, not such a huge deal. So
I guess there's also a sort of language or vocabulary that the superheroes developed, which, like, sort of has value. Like, I wouldn't want to, you know, disown somebody like Kirby or Ditko, who really developed a way of telling stories. And if you look at, say, the Hernandez brothers, I mean, part of what makes them great is that they totally absorbed that language and that vocabulary and internalized it to such a great degree that it's made them able to tell any story they want for like 20 years. And that sort of allergic reaction that Dan talked about.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the downside of it. Like, that people, you're not getting so many Hernandez brothers anymore. You know, young cartoonists that, like, just learn their storytelling chops.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point, because I was talking to somebody recently, a local cartoonist, about like influences, like and genres, and like how there isn't a hierarchy in genre. Like, superhero comics aren't inherently worse than you know, than autobiographical comics or something. But and people
there's a lot of crappy autobiographical.
Yeah, exactly.
Comics,
well,
yeah.
That, no, but that's my point. Like when you, what you were just saying about the influence of superhero comics. We were discussing this at a party the other night, and I was saying that. That I love it when you see somebody bring something fresh to comics, even if it doesn't really work. You'll see somebody that has no background in the history of comics, so they do something a little different, and you go, well, you know, that it actually could work in a way. But then you see other people that they do something different, and it doesn't work because I've seen why they did things in comics for 50 years. And you can look at it and say, well, if you put that balloon in front of the other one, now you're not reading the story the same. You know, just like little things where you see... like the, there was great things that came out of even the goofiest of comics can have any sort of good influence on things. You know. Anyway, sorry, I ranted.
Yeah, and the goofiest of comics can contain the most stunning.
Yes.
Art,
yes. Exactly.
Of that decade. You know, look at Alex Toth's entire career.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Or Jesse Marsh. I mean, these guys did the goofiest stuff.
Oh, I know.
It's so hard to like. Penetrate past the goofiness. But
Hot Wheels.
You do. You're in this
oh, yeah.
world of really astounding drawing.
Yeah, I mean, I remember that from the when the Comics Journal did like the top, what's it, top 100 greatest comics of all time or something, and they basically couldn't figure out a way, I don't think, to get Alex Toth. He might have appeared in like one issue or something, but it's like, how do you get these great artists that contribute so much to storytelling and design and influence?
It's hard. It's comics, you know. It's like. I saw Chinatown recently.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like that.
Yeah.
It's just Chinatown.
Yeah.
What are you gonna do?
That's awesome. That's exactly what it's like.
But it's a strange thing because, you know, I talk about this with Frank Santoro all the time. It's like, you know, we can talk all day about Toth and Marsh and all these guys, but ultimately we're going to read something else entirely to get actually nourished.
Mm-hmm.
And that's mm-hmm. kind of a bummer. But that's the beauty of the Hernandez brothers. They give you everything all at once.
Right. I was going to bring up as we're getting closer to the end of the show. We're not there, but we're getting closer.
Yeah,
I was going to ask, like, you know, it's like comics today. Like, in general, people that know about comics or care about them, they look at it as an art form. It's its own art form. And I was wondering what... are some of the challenges that you see, all of you, like what's some of the challenges that you see that comics have in the near future? Like how, like what are the sort of the roadblocks that we might be up against since we've, I don't know. Just
I'm worried for the newest generation in that I think that there, by historical accident, a lot of the greatest cartoonists came along at a time where they could, they had their, you know, their own comics, and they could experiment and work, and they had a, you know, making just enough money or had other means to kind of have this laboratory in order to get really good in a very specific way where they were driving the car. And I'm not sure that that is going to be the same of a generation of kids that might get to draw a graphic novel for Hill and Wang right after coming out of James Sturm's school.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's an accident that, you know, a huge bulk of the great comics work of the last 10 years came from artists who had a very specific way of coming up through the industry and you know, having their own comics and having that driving them and you know, doing them frequently. So I wonder if that's going to how the kind of boom is going to affect the art, you know, 8, 10, 12 years from now.
Mm-hmm. I think what you're seeing is a huge amount of unformed artists getting published too early and putting out bad books. I think that's going to be problematic. And then conversely, distribution has changed so much, even since, you know, the Megan Kelso, Tom Hart, Jason Lutz kind of boomed, what was it, like 10 or 12 years ago? Oh, mm-hmm. God, longer.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's not any longer any kind of mini comics exchange going on, really. That's kind of over. And you're not seeing... It's all a little too much too soon, and then I think a lot of the really great artists aren't necessarily cut out for that Hill and Wang graphic novel or whatever kind of schlocky, you know, generic fiction stuff is coming out. And so they're kind of left without anywhere to go. There's no real underground left anymore, and then the kind of mainstream isn't ready for them. So it's a strange in-between spot. And there's no more comic stores that really, I mean, there are like 10 of them that support it. I mean, you can't sell, what was it, like 10,000 copies of Yummy Fur anymore. It just doesn't exist. I don't know.
No, we do our best. And, yeah.
We do. We got. But you could sell 10,000 copies of, like, the worst graphic novel in the world.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the meanie in me.
Well, that's.
Yeah, and actually, just to sort of further reinforce that, it seems like there's a real bias in the bookstore market for narrative, for, like, you know, especially memoir or things that have real world issues. And some of the ones that have been successful are very good at that, but there's. It's hard for anything that's too experimental or odd or Gary Panter-ish, for want of a better word, to find a bookstore audience.
Yeah.
That something that I foresee, and I guess it's already happening, is kind of like the Persepolis factor, is people kind of, you know, that horrible movie industry aspect where people think, oh, hey, let's make money off this thing. You're going to see this glut of... You know,
or it's
saccharine.
Well, that's also the type of book that I haven't read the book, but just looking at it, I have a hard time getting over the visuals in it because I don't much care for it, and I think that it's one of those books that it's because it's autobiographical. There is I think there still is this sort of a hierarchy where people think that it's a true story, therefore it's worth. Something where if something was a fantasy, it wouldn't be looked at the same level, you know.
Right.
You know, that's kind of the impression.
You know, we've joked that you know, if you could somehow blend kind of a foreign displacement experience with concentration camps, with cancer, into some sort of life experience, you could probably sell that graphic novel, you know, advance rights for... Yeah. Several $100,000.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that is kind of true.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're pretty much near the end of our slot time now.
Mm-hmm.
Any last comments on the comics as art from any of you?
Mm-hmm. I know it's been a little bit strained. We might have left the topic a little vague, but kept for some good conversation, though.
Yeah. I vote yes.
Yes, there we go.
Me too. Up with comics.
Yes.
Up with comics. Yeah.
Well, that's the one thing I find out of every comic creator I look at that comes up with something interesting, the one thing they have in common is they all love comics. It doesn't matter if they're doing superheroes or doing autobiographical stuff, doing whatever. It's like, that. I think that in general, that's what really comes through the most to me and what I look for is for someone that actually cares. You know?
I've got one last question for the three of you.
Mm-hmm.
We're on radio, so it's not necessarily just people that listen to that, you know, read comics. Listen to the show. We have a lot of people that don't read comics that listen. What each of you, like one comic, maybe a couple, that you feel that really encompass the strengths of what you can see happen with comics?
I really like the new special edition of Palestine by Joe Sacco.
Mm-hmm.
I think that in all sorts of ways, that's just a lovely book of comics fruition. You know, is everything from the way he approaches his work to how the visuals are effective on the page to the intelligence of the scripting and the overall writing of the book. That's a perennial go back to from this time period for sure.
I actually lent it to my poli sci prof and he loved it. He inhaled it.
Also going back to the sort of late 80s, early 90s, the reissue of Love and Rockets in the new format, which I think is really reader friendly. And the achievement of Gilbert and Jaime in terms of writing about characters for, like, you know, 20 or 30 years and creating worlds that are so organic. I was thinking about this. The only comparable feat is actually someone like John Updike, who wrote about Harry Rabbit Angstrom for, like, 40 years. over, you know, many volumes and or created a real world.
Bukowski so writing about himself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dan?
I guess the things I've been most excited about have been, I really love the Omega the Unknown series.
Oh, Farrell.
Farrell is a friend of the Ink Studs. He's a talented boy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the writing is some of the best I've seen in comic books in a really long time. And I don't know, he's doing something with the form of the comic book, like how each issue is a satisfying read, but also planting seeds that then sort of sprout in later issues. I think the art's great. I'm really enjoying that just as a comic book. And it's been a long time since I actually looked forward to something like I look forward to things in life, but a comic book every month.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a while, so that's kind of a great feeling. Yeah, I love that.
I agree. Yeah, it reminds you. Yeah, it takes me back to when I really loved every comic I would pick up. You know.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, guys, for joining us, and you know. Keep doing the great stuff you've been doing.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, thank
you.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye. Hang. CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Ink Studs. The show about comics. Up next, what do we got up next, boys? Value Village People. Luke's going through some creative records. And do you guys have anything you want to play before you start, or
you can just play the PSA and then we'll pick up from where we left off.
Okay. Next week, our guest will be a couple people on to talk about the Illustrated Journey, which is a project about refugee children working with comic artists, kind of exploring what they've gone through coming to Canada. It looks really fascinating. Josue Menavar, and I forget the name of the other person, will be joining us. Hoshway is one of our fantastic local people.
Mm-hmm.
Week after that will be Brian K. Vaughn and Pia Guerrera, who will be talking about...
Pia Guerra.
She told me how to pronounce that the other day. And week after that will be Paul Hornsteimer. And if you don't know who Brian K. Vaughn is, you watch Lost, don't you?
See ya.
Let me get this straight.
Experimental days of broadcasting as such are over.
Thursday, January 17th, CITR celebrates Art's birthday with another 24 hours of radio art.
To confuse.
The Art of Sounds. Thursday, January 17th, midnight to midnight. 24 hours of radio art. Happy birthday, Art. From CITR 101.9 Vancouver for CITR.ca.
Well, of course, that's the sound you don't hear very often. But it is the real thing.
You must keep reminding yourself. It's just a
sound collage.
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 Only a madman could understand it all.
I can understand that.
One last game.
You do? What is it?
Well, it's a rhyme game.
Oh, boy.
And all the rhymes have to do with things that happen at a birthday party. Now, I'll recite the first part of the rhyme, and Big Bird, you and everyone else at the party can try and finish the rhyme.
Oh, well, I'm really good at rhyming.
You ready?
Yeah.
Okay, here's the first one. Whoever you are, one thing is clear. You have a birthday once a...
week.
No.
No, once a month.
No, it has to rhyme with clear.
Oh, let me see. Whoever you are, one thing is clear. You have a birthday once a year.
Right.
Oh. Right, you are Big Bird.
Hey, what's happening?
Art's birthday. We are hour 15 here on the almighty CITR 101.9 FM.
Yeah.
My name is Luke Meat.
I am Bleak of the Value Village People.
I am Luke of the Value Village People, and welcome to the beginning of our three-hour excursion of the Value Village People live in studio on CITR.
We're going to be playing some of the hits today and some the beginning of new hits.
We got a whole bunch of new stuff, actually. So stay tuned. If you want to participate, give us a shout here at 822-2487.
That's right.
And you can maybe even be a part of the art.
We may put you online.
Yes, indeedy.
If you got something to...
And, of course, this is being archived